Support for WPR comes from Focus on Energy. Committed to helping Wisconsinites focus on the planet by making smart energy choices. Energy resources for Earth Day and every day can be found at focusonenergy.com.
Go into the chapel and we're gonna get married. Go into the chapel and we're gonna get married.
Coming up on this edition of On Your Money, the high cost of weddings. Is there a better way to spend your money as you start to live happily ever after? Plus, paying for grad school and keeping a lid on food costs. And as always, answers to your personal finance questions. Good morning, I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Tuesday, August 14th, primary election day in Wisconsin. If you want results and analysis, hot off the voting machine, catch our election night special tonight starting at 8 here on the Ideas Network. And if you want to talk more about the results and the campaign trail ahead, join us here tomorrow morning between 6 and 8. Now, if you have a question for financial planner Kevin McKinley, call 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I always do that. You should send that email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money LLC, and he joins us from our studios in Eau Claire. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Joy.
Hey, Kevin. I met some fans of the show at my high school class reunion over the weekend. I went to my...
Plural.
What?
Wow.
I was really shocked.
Plural. More than one.
Yes, exactly. Actually, one of them, one of my classmates from 1977, said he listens all the time, but he never made the connection. He said, I didn't know you were that Joy Cardine.
Was his opinion raised of you or lowered after he found
I think he was impressed, but I kind of laughed because I thought, yeah, how many people have the name Joy Cardine around here? But, you know, I didn't take my husband's last name. I kept my maiden name. I thought Joy Starbucks sounded kind of funny.
There's still time.
I know.
If you want to renew your vows, you can probably throw that in there.
I know some people who have done that too. And I only bring that up because I know that we are going to talk about weddings and the cost of getting married. A recent survey found that the average cost of a wedding is more than $26,000.
Right, it's actually close to $27,000, according to an article in the USA Today and a survey conducted by Brides Magazine. That is a magazine, if you haven't seen it recently, it, right around this time of the year, weighs in at about 8.5 pounds, about 4.5 inches thick. When you hear that, especially for many of the On Your Money listeners and the sensibility, I would guess most of us spent less than that on our weddings, even if we've had several of them. The components of the $27,000, about $12,000 on average would go to the reception, about $5,000 for the engagement ring, and then a few thousand dollars each for the rings, the photography, the gown, the flowers, the cake, I guess bail money the next day, probably. Repairs at the VFW club, I guess, would probably be in there. I have someone I know very well who has been present at several thousand different weddings who says that he believes there is an inverse correlation between the cost of the wedding and the success of the marriage. And it does kind of stand to reason that if you are getting married so that you can have your big special day and all the attention on you, whatever, and you're not getting married to hopefully spend many years or a lifetime with this person, that you might end up disappointed. And if you are spending lots of money that you don't have on a wedding, that's going to leave you deep in debt and give you plenty of things to fight about shortly after the wedding is over and even before the thank you notes go out. So there, we found some more effective ways that, especially parents who have children who are getting married, that they might want to spend this money instead. And especially it's ironic because one can give another person up to $13,000 per year or half of that $26,000 figure with no gift tax ramifications whatsoever.
Yeah, so what would you recommend instead of that $27,000 wedding?
Well, let's start with something that many younger couples would like to have along with an expensive wedding, and that is their own new home. If you were to give a young couple $26,000 instead of paying for that wedding, you could use that money for a 10% down payment on a $260,000 house. It would be a very nice one in Wisconsin. Or even a simple home, $130,000 one. The couple could use that, make a 20% down payment on that home, and their new mortgage payment would probably be less than $500 per month, which would mean that's less than rent in many communities here. And plus, it would allow the young couple to get in on a fixed rate mortgage at a time when interest rates are very, very low. And the longer they can stay in that house, the more money they can accumulate other ways, because they don't have to make such a big savings for down payment or a big mortgage payment in the future.
Any other ideas?
I've seen this done before. Older couple wanted to help a younger couple out, and so they put a significant amount of money in a variable annuity for them. Said, we want this to be for your retirement, grow tax deferred. So $26,000 to an annuity that made a hypothetical return of, say, 6% per year. 35 years from now, that would be worth about $211,000. And an even better idea for a way to encourage that kind of saving is to say, look, we're going to match your contributions to your at-work retirement plan. And not only will $26,000 into a 401k or 403b save the couple about $5,000 in taxes, but it will still could leave several hundred thousand dollars by the time they retire, and it will get the couple in the habit of saving. So even after the matching funds have run out, they're having that money deducted from their paycheck, and they see it accumulate, see it grow, and they learn to live on a little less.
Couldn't they also use this $26,000 to pay off some debt?
Yeah, especially credit cards. $26,000 worth of credit card debt at the average interest rate of about 14%. That costs $300 a month just in interest, let alone actually paying that debt off. So that would be a nice, useful gift. Or it could save about $250 per month in student loan payments to pay off a $26,000 balance over 10 years. Now, a little bit of a word of caution on this. If you are giving this to people who are in debt, you may want to make some type of agreement that they are not going to go back in and use this new credit that you've established for them to charge it back up again and get back in the same hole if they can help it.
So what would you say to parents of the bride or the groom who might have a hard time saying no to paying for a big wedding like this?
It's fairly common that that the tradition of giving, you know, a herd of cattle or something else to the groom for the hand of taking the bride off your hands is gone by the wayside. About a third of couples, according to this survey, do pay for the entire wedding expenses themselves. And if you're an older couple and you have some child who is expecting you to step up for this, just be straight with them and say, you know, we may be able to give you $5,000 towards the cost of your wedding. If you can spend all of that on the wedding, great. If you can spend less than that, you can keep the difference. But if you want to spend any more than that, you're going to have to figure out coming up with that yourself. Or you can say, we can't help you right now. It's just not going to be possible. Or, and this has been an effective tactic in the past, to say, we're definitely going to pay for your lavish, very expensive wedding. We're going to give every penny we have to making sure this day is very special for you. However, it increases the chances that we will have to move in with you when we're retired. So if you're comfortable with that, let us know what the bill is and we'll give you everything we have.
Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. That being said, if you have a personal finance question that you would like Kevin to consider, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Time now for the On Your Money email bag, and we received an email from a very bright young woman who is heading off to get her MBA. And Kevin, she wants to know if she should use her savings to pay for this degree or get a loan.
She should definitely get a loan if she can, and there is a specific loan which she should get. It's called the PLUS loan, and generally they will give people loans in the amount of the difference between the actual cost of paying and whatever financial aid or grants might come from the institution. Typically covers grad school loans, either from the parent standpoint or from the student standpoint. Now, the interest rate is a little daunting at 7.9%, but there are special repayment features for these PLUS loans. Generally, the loans don't have to be repaid till the kid is out of school for at least 6 months. And even if they're going just half time, there still is basic deferment of the payment schedule. So at least it's not something that they have to turn around and start paying right away. In some cases, they can accrue interest, of course, but they don't have to start repaying it right away.
So it is then worth it, even though it's a pretty hefty interest rate.
Right. But if she or other people in her situation get through school and not only does this degree lead to a job, but more income or whatever, she might have moving expenses if she's going to take a different job in another area. If she doesn't pay for the school right away out of pocket, she's going to have that cash on hand to not only cover all those different issues, but also to bide her time so she doesn't have to take a job that she doesn't want just so she can repay the loans. And there are cases, excuse me, where she might even get help from her employer to help pay off the loans as well. And if she is stuck, she doesn't get the job she wants, she can at least use the savings to just make the minimum payments required by the student loans to keep them current until she gets the job she wants and has the earnings that she needs to justify getting this MBA.
Would you say, Kevin, that getting a loan for grad school is always better than using your savings?
Surprisingly, for us in this show, no. If you have a bad credit history, you probably, if you can't get a cosigner, you probably can't get a PLUS loan. If you're getting a private loan, you don't understand the terms, or the interest rate seems higher than 7.9%, no. If you are worried that you'll have savings and you'll get a loan and then you'll spend the savings in a way that you would have regret, no. Don't get the loan. Or if the assets you have on hand might prevent you from getting need-based aid. And again, I would caution people, the amount of need-based aid that's out there is relatively small. Most people who do get financial aid, it is in the form of loans. So depleting your assets just to qualify for aid is usually a pipe dream, doesn't come very often. And if you do have the savings, the income to pay for going to grad school, that's usually a good way to start the answer to the question of, can I afford to go to grad school or should I go to grad school? If you have savings and income to pay for it, it's usually a better idea than if you say, I'm completely broke, I have nothing else going on in life, I think I'll go to grad school and that'll be my big ticket. We will be covering this in just a few weeks, first part of October, when we have our next pledge drive. Our On Your Money mini money book is going to be a brand new one called Covering College Costs. And we're going to be covering from before birth until after grad school, how families can cover the amazing and rising cost of higher education.
Ooh, that'll be a good one. And if you have a question about paying for college or grad school right now, if you have a question about paying for weddings or any other personal finance question, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine with financial planner Kevin McKinley, and Chris in Menominee apparently has some suggestions about saving money on weddings. Chris?
Yes, Joy. So my wife and I were able to pay our wedding with help of our parents for about 140 people, and it cost us, I think, about less than $7,000. We ended up getting a hall for around $130. They weren't picky on what type of cake we could bring in, so that helped us in our selection of caterers. And as far as, like, you know, the bar goes at the reception, we paid for like a keg in the first two, drinks at the bar. Among that, our wedding invitations were like $60. We bought them online. They look great. And
the dress was $5,000 then, or what?
No,
his tux was.
The dress was only $500. My wife found something she liked, and we went with that.
Well, that's excellent. I was going to say, you really, really had a lot of bargains there. I didn't even know how it added up to $7,000. It sounded like it was such a deal. So you can have a nice, beautiful wedding and reception, Kevin, without paying $27,000.
Absolutely. And even if, you do spend quite a bit of money on it, if you just change things around a bit, tweak a little bit, instead of the dollar dance, have the $100 dance. And 15 or 20 dances, $100 bills start to fill up the bucket, and you should have the whole thing paid for.
Good idea. Chris, thank you for those that great example. If you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, and this is On Your Money here on the Ideas Network.
Greenback paper bill. Yes, just a little piece of paper coated with chlorophyll.
You're listening to On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine along with financial planner Kevin McKinley. 1-800-642-1234 if you have a question for Kevin, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Karen in Oshkosh is with us next. Good morning, Karen.
Good morning, Kevin. I love your show. Enjoy, too.
Well, thank you.
My husband and I are receiving $69,000 from a cash-out refi, and we're wondering where should we park this money, and then how much should we set aside for an emergency fund?
Well, good for you. You are one of the few people who actually follows our advice on this show, Karen, so thank you for your kind words and actually listening to us. And I also love the way you throw out the term cash-out refi. That
I
just
love
sounds
that,
like
yeah.
a cool finance term, so good for you. Cash-out refi, for people who haven't heard before, are when you get a mortgage, I think it's a good idea to get the mortgage for 80% of the value of the home, even if you don't necessarily need the money like Karen. And that you'll get cash back on this. And the reason being is that interest rates are extremely low. Valuations that appraisers are willing to give to homes for mortgages are still fairly high. And lenders are still willing to lend. And some or all of those components might change in the future, or your personal situation might change. You might not be able to get the loan in the future. And if everything goes great for you in the housing market, the lending business, you can always repay the loan with virtually no penalty and very little cost. But if you do need the money, you'll be very glad that you do have this extra cash. Karen, are you and your husband still working?
Yes.
Okay. Are you maxing out your pre-tax retirement plan savings?
Yes, we fully fund our Roth and we max out our TSAs every year.
Okay, great. And the TSA, are you over 50 or not?
No, we're both 47.
Okay, well, in a couple of years, you'll be able to bump that up, right? You get the catch-up provision for many pre-tax retirement savings plans. You can probably get up in the $22,000 or $23,000 piece bracket, correct?
I believe so. I'm not sure.
Okay. So that's one way I would do that, is save that money aside and just make sure you can always max that out, because if you can afford to max it out and you're both working, you're probably in the 25% federal tax bracket. And by maxing out a pre-tax deferral, using those proceeds to live on while you defer more money from your paycheck into this pre-tax plan, you're going to save about 25 to 30 cents or so for every dollar that you get into that pre-tax plan. So in other words, if you were able to contribute an extra $10,000 into that pre-tax plan, it will cut about $2,500 to $3,000 on your income taxes in that particular year. So that's a great way to get an immediate return on it. Do you have any other bigger expenses coming up? Are you looking at a home remodeling? Are you paying for someone's college? Are you concerned about healthcare costs for a parent?
No, we're focusing on just hoarding our money for retirement. And we have some college funds, or a college fund set up for both of our children. And we need new carpeting.
Okay, that's, good. You don't want new carpeting. You need new carpeting.
We need it.
Yeah, I would get the new carpeting. That's not a question of if it's an expense that's going to come up. It's just a case of when you actually do it. So I would definitely, if you have upcoming home remodeling, not only, you know, do you get some benefit back from that in the form of an appreciated value of the home, but you also get to enjoy it because you're in it. You don't have to apologize to guests, or better yet, just draw your shades and lock the door and never let anybody in because you're so embarrassed about your carpeting. So I would definitely do that. And you have children. They're teenagers?
8 and 11.
Oh, 8 and 11. Okay, so they will be teenagers. I have several really wise, frugal, very conservative-minded people who have done exactly what you are doing, Karen, with the notion that they can borrow money at, say, 3.5% right now for 30 years on their mortgage by refinancing. And they know that their children will probably not be able to borrow money, whether it's to go to school or to buy a new home or to buy a car or something, in the future at that same very, very reasonable term. So they're borrowing it for themselves so that they can either give that money to their kids for college or a house or a car or something in the future, or lend it to them and maybe even charge them a little more and make the difference for it, but also have a loan that they can get. And if your kids never need that money or you never want it, it's a nice thing to have. Now, then the question is where do you put it for the time being, right?
Yes.
Okay, we're roughly 8 minutes into this conversation before I finally got to the answer.
She wants to know where to park it, Kevin.
Where to park it. Yeah. All right. Where to park her cash out refi. Two favorite conservative investments, Karen. One is Series I savings bonds, which we've covered in the last couple of weeks, pay about 2.2%. That rate is adjusted every 6 months, and it's very safe. You can get the money out fairly easy. And then I would also look out at very long-term CDs. If you go to google.com/advisor, you'll get a listing of Google has put together some of the highest-paying certificates of deposit around the country. You are going to be very disappointed with the rates on those high-paying CDs. But as long as you get one that pays you a couple percent and has very little penalty for early withdrawal, that's a nice place to park the money and partially offset the interest costs that you'll be paying and then be able to have access to the money in the future when you need it for something more urgent.
And I think, Karen, you also wanted to know how much you should have in an emergency fund?
Yes.
Yeah.
Just something that we won't touch.
Yeah, rule of thumb, somewhere between 1 year's worth of your living expenses, add up your monthly living expenses, figure out what you would need to cover a year worth of that, and 25% of your assets if you are nearing retirement or retired, meaning if you have $200,000, you should have at least $50,000 set aside in something that's not making you any money but isn't losing you any money and is immediately accessible with little or no cost. So somewhere between a year's worth of living expenses and 25% of your overall paper net worth.
Sound good, Karen?
Okay. Yes, thank you very much.
Thank you. Enjoy that cash out refi. I like that too. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, and Kathy in Elkhart Lake is with us next. Hello, Kathy.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, I'm at the flip end of the weddings and the college, financing college, and we are looking at long-term health care insurance.
Mm-hmm.
And we thought we're both 65. I'm retired. My husband is not. We're in fairly good health, I should say pretty good health. And we're looking at a policy that would cover both of us unlimited. But it's pricey, $11,000 a year. However, it does have a cap. We only have to pay for it for 10 years, and then it's paid for. And supposedly this long-term health care insurance will cover both of us if we are in a nursing home for an unlimited number of years. And I'm just wondering what he thinks about long-term health care insurance, whether it's a good buy for protecting your assets or if it's something that almost prices you out right out of the market.
It does sound pricey, Kevin.
Yeah, well, he thinks that, first of all, he's happy that you're using some of his favorite words when you're discussing any kind of financial proposition, especially one related to insurance, and that is supposedly. I like the word ostensibly. I would like allegedly. All of those terms are very good ones to keep in mind when you're describing the features of a particular investment proposition or insurance policy. I'm guessing here, without you reading the 250-page prospectus to me, Kathy, is that you're going to put a bunch of money in, and the insurance company is going to be so smart and clever with it that they're going to then invest it, then make enough to start generate to cover the premiums. Is that something that's been alluded to in the conversations with the agent?
A little bit, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
I don't like this. I like long-term care insurance if it makes you feel good to own it. I don't like the notion of putting a bunch of money in and then hoping that some other party, which quite frankly has, is the last thing they want to do is pay this money out. And if I ran an insurance company and took in premiums, my main goal would be to take in as much as possible and pay out as little as I possibly can. So you want to give them as little as you possibly can to get the coverage in. What I would much rather have you do is if you are going to get the policy, and I do think you should look at it. I think people who have paper assets between $200,000 and $2 million should probably look at long-term care insurance. They may not want to get it, but you should definitely at least consider it. And if you are in that category, I'd much rather have you get a policy that just you pay month by month rather than super funding the thing right now and then hoping that it's still there when you need it. Because when you get in the door and you get the policy, Kathy, it becomes a new 30-day proposition, meaning that all you have to do is when the premium is due is decide, do we want this insurance for the next 30 days? We do. Okay, can we afford this probably $150 to $200 or so to keep it going for 30 more days? Is this the best thing for us? Then yes, let's send this check in. And if any of those things aren't true, you can stop sending it in. And you don't have to worry about, gosh, we gave this company all of our money. Are they going to be in business? Are they going to want to pay it out? Are we going to have a condition that's actually covered under the policy? I'd much rather have you do it very slow and low rather than giving a bunch of money up front and then hoping that, you know, there's some magic beans down the road that will come to fruition and pay off for when you need it. And I'm willing to bet that the policy actually allows for that. For some reason, they're trying to sell you one that takes a bunch of money up front with the promise that you'll never have to pay again.
That's interesting, because one of the things that I liked about that was, or the policy that they're offering, is that it would be paid up in 10 years. Because my fear was that I would pay on this insurance policy for 7 years and then not be able to afford it as we got older due to cost of living or whatever. And then I had put all this money out, and when I got to the dangerous years of when I might actually need this insurance, I could no longer afford the premium.
In a perfect world, that would be a good assumption. But the problem is that many of these insurance companies are not only not interested in taking on new clients for long-term care policies, but they may be dropping the coverage altogether. And unless someone else is willing to step in and pick up the policy holders, those people are left in the lurch. Now, I don't think that's going to happen, and I hope it doesn't in your case. But if it does, it'll be disappointing to have paid all this money in and then scramble around and try to find someone who's willing to pick up your policy, especially when you're older and you're more likely to need it. Much rather have you pay as you go, get in now while you can, and then only pay a little bit for it and view it as a month-to-month basis. And quite frankly, Kathy, for you and other people out here in this situation, I pay homeowners insurance. And I didn't get to the end of, say, 2011 and say, darn it, we paid all that money in homeowners insurance and our house didn't burn down or we weren't robbed. I was happy that those things didn't happen, but I had insurance in place in case that they did. You should view long-term care insurance the same way. You should view it to cover something that you hope doesn't happen, but if it does, it will help protect you and your assets.
Good luck, Kathy. Thank you very much for the call. If you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. It's time now for Smart Assets, and millions of students are heading off or back to college right now. I know that we are this week in Madison looking forward to move-in. It's going to be a move-out, move-in, and what do they call it, hippie Christmas with all the junk all over the...
Yes, it's also known as $10 sofas sitting on the curb in the rain. It's one of the most nicer attributes of every college town in America right now.
And that's going to happen this week. But there are several financial steps that students and their parents should be taking right now. Right, Kevin?
Yes, and it's even if, you know, your kid's not going to school. Kid's moving out and you still think that you either want to be or maybe held responsible for his or her actions or condition, you might want to have this conversation right now. It's a very sensitive subject. Talking about money with this person who is neither child nor adult should be covered now rather than waiting for a bad thing to happen and then figuring out how to pick up the pieces. So there are lots of things people can be doing that can help prevent you from having to bail the kid out or letting him suffer and learn a valuable lesson.
So where should they start?
I would look at deciding how much freedom the kid is going to spend. These habits that he or she develops in early adulthood, if you will, can last a lifetime in terms of monitoring spending, spending less than you bring in and less than you have. So sit down and write down prospective expenses on a sheet of paper in advance and then track them together via spreadsheet, if you have an online solution or software that you want to do it with, and start following up each week and say, how much money did you spend? Where did it go? And then if it seems like, you know, it's kind of like riding a bike. You start out with the tricycle and then you move to the training wheels and then you take the training wheels off and expect that the kid is going to fall down and hurt him or herself or get mad at you. But as you kind of see, push them going forward and you see them learning how to do it, you can give them a little more freedom, not have to monitor every single penny, and let them figure out how to do it themselves. One good way to do this is to have the kid set up a checking account, a savings account at a bank or credit union, but then have the parent on as an interested party who can check it. And if the parent says, well, the kid is balking and having me on, is this, say, well, gosh, I want to be on there in case I need to deposit any money for you in the future. And the kid will say, oh, thanks. That's a great idea. I'd love to have you on there.
What about credit cards? Should parents give or should students get credit cards?
I am actually not averse to this. If the parent is on board, it can help the student not only build a valuable credit history, but also learn how to use cards responsibly, meaning use the plastic to cover when they either don't have cash or don't have cash on them, but then to pay it off as soon as possible. A good way to do this is to get the card with the parent, almost a joint account, if you will, and then say, you know, make a rule that as part of this, you have to check with me, text or call me before you use this at all so we can discuss it and I can approve it. You might want to set up a $500 limit that can, you know, that's a short leash so that the kid can't get into too much trouble. But then if there really is an honest-to-goodness emergency, you're kind of out of luck that way. So that might be another reason to set up a larger limit, like a few thousand dollars. After you decide whether or not the kid is going to get a credit card, then you want to freeze the kid's credit report if he or she will let you. And that will not only help prevent them from having their identity stolen, but also prevent them from opening up credit cards that you would just as soon they not open up. And you can go to privacy.wi.gov to help freeze someone else's credit report or your own.
All right. So then what other financial steps should a college student or their parents take?
It's time to look at your insurance. Sometimes renter's insurance is recommended in this case, unless the kid has, you know, a really amazing computer setup or stereo system or a $5,000 bike. It's typically not worth it to get this policy because between the premiums and the deductible and the relatively low replacement value of the kids' items, it can be done out of pocket. A more important issue is health care insurance. Now, many younger adults are on their parents' health insurance, but it's a good way to not only confirm that now, but also to get the HIPAA powers so that if your kid is away in a distant location, that you already have established access. So you can check on him or her if there is some kind of health care. Many healthcare facilities will not let anyone get information on the status of a patient if that patient is an adult and there are no papers in place. If the kid is taking a car, you probably need to call your auto insurance agent and update that change in status. And if the kid is moving out of the house and not taking a car, then you want to call the auto insurance as well and say, I do not have this reckless, irresponsible teenager driving my car around. Please lower my premiums commensurately.
Cool. Good idea. So are you still against the student getting a job while going to college?
If it means taking less credits, if the choice is working 10 hours a week or taking 3 more credits per semester, I'd much rather have them take the 3 credits. Generally, student jobs don't pay very much. They're difficult to get. The hours can be horrible. And most kids who do go to college and even get a degree don't get out in 4 years, and many times it's because they're not taking enough credits. And usually half the cost of going to college are living expenses. And the more years that a kid goes to school, the more living expenses he or she is going to have. So if it's something that, you know, pays well, it doesn't impinge on the kid's academics, if it is something that might lead them to, let's say, you know, students going to veterinary school and has a chance to work in a vet clinic, that's a great job to take for a student. But if it's, you know, swinging shots at Jägermeister at 2 o'clock in the morning, unless that's going to be your profession, it's probably not something you would want your son or daughter doing. And rather than staying home studying or getting a good night's sleep for class the next day.
All right. Sounds good. By the way, a program note here. Tomorrow at this time, this will be good. I'm going to be talking with the author of the book, The Naked Roommate and 107 Other Issues You Might Run Into in College. So we'll talk about...
I think I lived with that guy.
You might have. He went to UW-Madison, Kevin.
I think so.
Anyway, that's tomorrow. We're going to kind of focus in on roommates and how to cope with roommates and get along with roommates and maybe share some stories about the best and worst roommates we've ever had. That's tomorrow between 8 and 9. Let's next go to Brian in Fort Atkinson. Hi, Brian.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I had a question about the EdVest program and the change that's going to happen with the administration of it. I typically make a lump sum contribution for my kids to EdVest, and I was wondering if it's worth it to make it this year into the portfolio that Wells Fargo provides, or if I should wait and see what TIA CREF has and make my decision then, if there's a difference there. And generally, kind of what your opinion about those age-based portfolios and the change they go through relative to just doing it myself.
We mentioned this a few weeks ago, Brian. I'm glad you brought it up again. The EdVest program is a state-sponsored 529 college savings program sponsored by the state of Wisconsin but farmed out to various mutual fund companies. And these contracts to run this plan come up every few years. Well, Wells Fargo does not want to run it, so it's going out to TIA CREF. Vanguard has been a part of it in the past. The Strong Funds were one of the first funds to be in this. And they're making a change again. And Brian's question is a good one, except I don't think the answer really matters because the primary advantage at the – well, there are actually two advantages to saving for college. One is you hopefully accumulate money for college. The advantage to using the EdVest program, though, is that it does give a small income tax break at the state level to Wisconsin residents who contribute to it. You can contribute to this plan for a student in any state to go to just about any school. And if it's a near relative within your, you know, immediate circle of family, you can deduct up to $3,000 of income from the state taxable level per deposit that you've for $3,000 that you put in. Now that ends up saving most people on the $3,000 might save about $100 to $125 in state taxes for it. I wouldn't wait just for the manager change. It's going to be a horse apiece whether you do it now or later. If you can get it in this year and still get the tax deduction for this year, it has to be in by the end of the calendar year to get the tax break, I would do that. And you can change it down the road if you don't like either the managers or whatever. In terms of saving for college, many well-meaning parents want to save for college. The problem is that you can borrow money to go to college. You cannot borrow money to retire. So much in the same way that parents who are flying with children are recommended to put your own oxygen mask on first and then hopefully remember to put the kids' oxygen mask on if something should happen. You should do the same thing with saving. You should save for your own retirement first. And then if you have extra money, use that for college. And if you have a well-funded retirement when your kids are either in college or getting out, you can help them pay off their loans or write them a check at that point. The best vehicle most middle-income parents have to save for retirement and college is the Roth IRA. Do you have Roth IRAs right now, Brian?
I do, and I fully fund them.
Okay, good for you. The reason I like that so much is that it's tax-free in retirement from a Roth IRA withdrawal. But if you want to use the money now or for college or whatever reason, you can pull the contributions you've been making out with no taxes or penalties whatsoever at any time and for any reason, including college. And so once your kids get older, you can look at your situation and say, you know what, we're doing pretty well for retirement. I think I'm going to start pulling money out of the Roth IRAs. There'll be no taxes or penalties as long as it's designated as the contribution portion of the account. So Roth IRAs first and EdVest second.
Thanks, Brian. Good luck to you. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, Certified Financial Planner, Managing Member of McKinley Money, LLC. Coming up on this edition of On Your Money, keeping the lid on food costs and our website of the week and more of your personal finance questions. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org.
I'm all lost in the supermarket. I can no longer shop happily. I came in here for a special offer. Guaranteed personality.
Don't be surprised if you get sticker shock when you visit the supermarket in the next few weeks and months. I'm Joy Cardine. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, talking with certified financial planner Kevin McKinley. And the food prices are on their way up, Kevin?
Well, yeah, but first, do you get the impression, Joy, that when Bill can't find an appropriate song for the segment, that he just makes it up himself with a Casio keyboard and sings it, and then
that was
could
Bill.
Be doing it live even?
That's why I couldn't understand the lyrics. Okay, that was Bill.
Still a nice effort. A really good hustle on your part, Bill. Thank you.
It was actually the Clash, apparently, by the way.
Fair enough. I've heard of them. We've covered the macroeconomic reasons a few weeks ago on why the drought affecting corn prices and so many different products that we see in the supermarket, including animal feed, is going to lead to higher prices in the grocery store. But also we've had a bump up in fuel prices as well. And just about all those goods and products you see on the aisles got there through the use of a petroleum-powered vehicle, so higher gas prices mean higher prices for them as well. And a lot of people think, well, you know, it's a few percent increase, sure, no problem at all. A 5% increase for the average family of four grocery bill can lead to an extra $500 to $1,000 per year in cost. So we definitely think you're going to be very unpleasantly surprised with prices that you see in the next few weeks and few months, and you might want to start taking action now to mitigate the damage.
Well, what can we do now? Where should savvy supermarket shoppers start?
Well, in the old days, Joy, people apparently went to the supermarket or the market or the grocer or whatever and bought what was there and then had that dictate what they ate. Whereas we've been spoiled over the last several decades. We make our list. We know it's going to be there and it's going to be in the form that we need it to be. And then we just buy it and go home. Mm-hmm. We have to go back to the old way of shopping where rather than making a list and going in and buying everything, you should probably go in and look for what is on sale, what supermarkets and stores are using as almost loss leaders, if you will, and buying those items and planning your menu around those. And especially if you can make it quickly and eat it, or more importantly, freeze it. So if you haven't already, this is a great time to make some of the three best investments I can think of, especially for controlling your food expenditures. That's a crock pot and a big freezer, and then use your microwave to heat things up that you've been able to assemble for yourself. Also, you want to try to avoid buying liquid. And the best example of this is buying a jug of pre-made orange juice versus the concentrate. Usually the concentrate is about 20 to 30% of the cost of the jug. And part of the reason of that is because the liquid takes up more space and it costs more to transport it. So buy everything down in as concentrated formula as you can. Cook it yourself, freeze it, label it, and date it. And this is something, I know someone who does this, they have the big stand-up freezer, right? And then they have attached a whiteboard to the door of the freezer, the top of the door. Sure. And they write not only what's in there when they put something in there, but they date it. So you don't have to open the freezer, waste all the energy searching around through all these, you know, vague brown icicles looking to see what it actually is. You know not only when you put it in there, but kind of where it should be in the freezer, so you have a good inventory right there.
And you know, we just along those lines, we just did a program on freezing and preserving your garden bounty that's going on right now. So that's another way you can put that in there too.
Absolutely.
What are some other tips for those who want to keep a lid on food costs?
Well, we have most of us have a very passionate connection to our favorite supermarket, partially because we spend several thousand dollars there, but it provides us with sustenance and we're there at least once every week. You might have to start spreading out your inventory among several different stores. You know, a gas station like Quick Trip might have a lower cost on milk than your supermarket or bananas. Some of the superstores out there might have lower costs on some items that they're having in sales. Some of the food co-ops might be selling things that are less expensive at the food co-op than they are at traditional supermarkets. And if you are concerned about overspending, if you go through the aisles and say, you know, I can't help myself. That's so clever. Everything's so cleverly placed. You know, I hear the voice telling me to start buying this stuff, and I end up spending way more than I want. Set your grocery budget and then take cash and only cash. No checkbook, no credit card, no debit card. And I guarantee you will not spend more than you have in your pocket on your particular groceries. Another idea to help cut your food expenditures is to throw out less of what you eat. And that doesn't mean eating garbage, but it means putting a list next to the garbage or the garbage disposal. And whenever you throw a food item out, write that it down. And if you see, you know, bananas or apples or rutabagas or whatever showing up on this list frequently, you might want to say, hey, you know what? We end up buying this stuff. We never end up eating it. Let's stop buying this because we just end up throwing it out anyway.
Well, we know the drought certainly affected corn prices. Are other vegetables besides corn rising in prices?
To some extent, but not nearly as severe. And especially right now, a lot of the food markets, farmers markets are in full bloom right now. They have some really great produce, and it's usually much less expensive than getting it all the way in the produce aisle at the supermarket. So if you can go there, especially if you're going there, you know, Saturday morning, you usually have the most of the day. Buy what you can, get home, get on the web, and start looking for recipes to cook that stuff up in a hurry and then freeze it. And you not only get some really fresh food, help out a smaller grower probably, but you'll also save some money in the meantime as well.
Sounds good. We have callers still waiting, so let's take some more calls. Maddie in Wapaka is with us. Hello, Maddie.
Good morning. Someone told me that if you have a will but do not have a trust, preferably a revocable trust, it may cost thousands to go through probate. Is that true?
Yes, it actually is true. But just by nature, having a revocable trust does not mean that you don't need a will, and it also does not necessarily preclude you from spending thousands of dollars in probate anyway. A revocable trust is basically an item that you can kind of establish a vehicle while you're alive, that how you want your assets to be titled. It is revocable, so it's not, if you decide to set one up and you change your mind, you can pull it back out, and usually there are no ramifications for it. But it does help avoid probate, and probate is typically not so much that it's expensive usually. I mean, it costs money to do it, but it's typically a very long process, and especially if you have heirs who are looking to, who need this money or don't want to get dragged through this, the revocable trust can help manage the distribution of the assets more quickly than a will can. So I would definitely, Maddie, do you have a revocable trust or a will?
A will, but not a revocable trust.
Okay. Do you have a lawyer maybe in town whom you trust and you could talk with about this?
Not really.
Okay. Well, we'll put up a couple links at onyourmoney.com that you can go to not only get more information about revocable trust. The state of Wisconsin, the state bar has some very good information on it, but also a couple links where you can search for a lawyer. And I would recommend that you try to find someone either whom you trust or someone who specializes in this kind of estate planning, because the more complex your situation is, the more expensive a mistake can be, and you don't want someone who generalizes to try to handle a very complex situation. So if you go to onyourmoney.com later on today, Maddie, we'll put those links up, and then you can search for more information on whether you need a revocable trust, and if so, how to find someone who can prepare one for you.
Good luck, Maddie. Thanks for calling. Justin in Green Bay, we have, I hope, time for you. Hi, Justin.
Hi, Joy. Hi, Kevin. First of all, I do want to say that this is a great show for me to be listening to. I'm a 20-year-old recent college grad, so I'm one of your younger listeners.
Wow, and you're
a college grad. Back up. 20 as in 20,
yeah.
Justin?
Really?
Yes.
He's a whiz kid.
College, I mean technical college, but still.
I don't care. Yeah. That's a piece of paper that says college on it at the age of 20 is fantastic, so good for you.
Congratulations.
Yeah. And debt-free, mind you.
So far.
Yeah, so far, I actually did not have to take out a single student loan.
I wish we had the whole hour to devote to you, but we are almost out of time. Is there a quick way to phrase your question?
Yeah, my question is, this may take a little bit of time for him to explain, but I was wondering if you could tell me the difference between a Roth IRA, a traditional IRA, and a 401k.
Yeah, it only will take two to three hours.
One minute, go.
Roth IRA and traditional IRAs, you control yourself. A 401k you need to do through your employer. You can contribute more money to the 401k generally, but you have more control over the investments of the Roth IRA and traditional IRA. And I'll make you a deal, Justin, if you are kind enough, because you're so kind to talk so nicely about the show. If you listen in the future, we'll do an entire segment devoted to the differences between the Roth IRA, traditional IRA, and the 401k.
Justin, thank you so much. And again, congratulations. So, Kevin, we just have time now for the website of the week.
Yes, ziplist.com helps you organize your entire menu, your grocery shopping, alerts you to sales at your favorite supermarkets and stores in the area, and it can help you save lots and lots of money on spending and eating. Ziplist.com, and we'll have that website up at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
And I know, Kevin, that you will be off the radio show next week. I hope you're going to be able to get a little vacation in.
I absolutely am. I looked up the meaning of the word, and I understand now what a vacation is, so I think I will take one.
Good. Four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley, certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. We wish him a wonderful vacation next week, and he will be back the week after that, back on the 28th. We'll have another guest talking about financial information, personal finance information with us next week for another edition of On Your Money. Thanks to Bill Martins and to Amanda Magnus for producing this program. Thank you for listening. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.